Good morning, Dr. Ross. How are you on this fine Saturday morning?
I'm fine, thank you, Brent. How are you, my friend?
I can't complain, mate. No one listens.
No, they never do.
They never do they, Ross?
No, they never do.
You got a minute to talk to me about it?
I do. Get on with it, my friend.
Let's do some listener questions, okay?
Yep.
This is from Jeff. Jeff says, was thinking about Dr. Ross's comments on water in plastic bottles, which we talked about last weekend, and the fact that water today comes from the mains in the street and through the pipes in my house that are now all made of plastic, not copper anymore. Could you ask him if filters should be made compulsory on our water?
Look, he's probably right, and this is the problem, that we just don't know how much all of these things are affecting our health. And in fact, the editorial I gave on my show last Sunday night was about this very subject. It was about all these forever chemicals they're now finding in the water supply. They closed down Medlow Bath Dam up in the Blue Mountains because they found, I think, 100 times the normal level of these forever chemicals in the water in the dam. And in fact, in Australia, and two articles in the Herald from the 24th of August suggested that the levels we have, that we accept of forever chemicals in our water, is something like 140 times what they will accept in the US. So you've got to ask yourself the question, what is the safe dose of a poison? And I would like to think probably no poison at all. But we just don't know how many of these chemicals are getting into our bloodstream. And in fact, a study that was just released from the University of Adelaide in a thing called the Annals of Global Health looked at all of these different plastics, BPA, polychlorinated biphenyls, otherwise known as PCBs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, then the forever chemicals, the polyfluoroalkyl substances, which just don't seem to get out of the body, which is why they're called forever chemicals, are linked to multiple adverse health effects. Now, listen to these ones. Miscarriage, low birth weight, obesity, hypertension, asthma, bronchitis, precocious puberty, endometriosis, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and potentially buckets of cancer. So all of these hormonal aberrations, all the things it's doing to our systems. And this was a study, 52 systematic reviews in 1.5 million people. So I share Jeff's concerns. Should we put filters on these things? Well, maybe just responsibility to do it yourself. Put a filter on your own water supply so you're not getting these synthetic chemicals and other chemicals. They're not just plastics. They're all the synthetic chemicals that are being exposed to.
I think it is so important that we do exactly what you just said and we put filters on our own taps, and that's easy to do. I mean, but once you do that, you've got to make sure that you update that filter and you change it when it needs to be changed, and you don't just think that it stays there once it's installed.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's like anything. It's like your air conditioning. If you don't get that service once a year, then that doesn't work properly. So same thing with filters on water taps and pipes and everything else.
Dino says, I fell over several days ago, but a bruise has only just shown up this morning. Dino says, is this normal, or how long should it take for a bruise to show, and how long do they last?
It really depends on how deep the break in the blood vessels were. So when you get a bruise, what happens is you rupture capillaries and sometimes veins. So if you've got a really deep bruise, you mightn't see it for a while until it leaches its way up to the surface. And when you think about the skin, blood vessels, anything else, they come in layers, a bit like the rings of a tree. And so it takes some time for this to, as I say, make its way to the surface. So it just really depends on where it was, whether the actual break in the capillaries occurred, how close it was to the surface. Sometimes you see the bruising immediately if it's a superficial break. So, and in terms of how long it takes to resolve, we've all seen this in our own bruises when we've developed them. Initially, they might be a bit blue, then they go as a yellowy-green colour over a few days. They take usually about 10 days till they resolve completely.
Maria has asked, can you take too much folic acid, or B, I suppose, can you take too much magnesium?
Yeah, the answer to both is definitely yes. And we spoke, I think it was last week, about folic acid. And the concern I have is that the old folic acid that has been out for years, is okay for half the population, but for the half of us, and I'm one of them, that has a mutation in this MTHFR gene, methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene, which is a vital gene that controls epigenetics. So epigenetics is basically how our environment interacts with our genes. And this MTHFR gene is one of the key genes involved in whether your genes are switched on or switched off. And so we used to think folic acid was the good thing to take. But what we find out now is that if you have this mutation in this MTHFR gene, which, as I said, 50% of people do, and you take standard folic acid, it's like it beats up against the brick wall, and it just keeps building up in your bloodstream because you're not metabolizing it properly if you've got the mutation. So I'm suggesting that all people should have the fourth generation folic acid, which is 5' methyl tetrahydrofolate in the glucosamine salt that bypasses that genetic abnormality, and it doesn't matter. And unfortunately, there's only one multivitamin in Australia that has the 5' methyl tetrahydrofolate glucosamine salt, and I can't say what that is on air. And you can get the 5' methyl tetrahydrofolate glucosamine salt in a supplement by itself as well. But I have a bit of a concern with that 50% of people being exposed to folic acid because, and this is the issue, as you get older, if you have that mutation, it actually builds up in the bloodstream and can damage your immune system. So a study was done over a 10-year period called the aspirin colonic polyp study, where they gave people placebo-controlled aspirin and/or folic acid 1 milligram a day, and they found that in the men who over the age of 55 who were given the folic acid compound had a 3 times higher rate of prostate cancer, and I believe it's because those were the men that had the MTHFR gene abnormality. The folic acid built up too much in the bloodstream, the unmetabolized folic acid, and damaged the immune system, which predisposed them to getting cancers. So what I'm saying to people is, avoid taking high doses of folic acid for that reason. And you see standard folic acid in most multivitamins apart from one, as I said. Now, in terms of magnesium, completely different story. Yes, you can take too much magnesium. And if that builds up too much in your bloodstream, that can cause irritability of the heart and a few other issues. So again, I think magnesium is a good thing to take. And the standard dose is somewhere between 400 to 800 milligrams twice a day, but no more than that. I don't think you need to be taking more than that. But magnesium is good for your body, but it's like anything. If you have a couple of cups of coffee a day, that's good for you. If you have 6 a day, it increases risk for a heart attack by 20%. If you have maybe a glass or 2 of wine a day, there may be, I'm not saying there is, may be a weak health benefit, but you'd have more than that on a regular basis every day, there's a problem with it. So like everything in life, it's all about dose, what the Buddhists call the middle path.
Donald says, or you have said you take a bucket of supplements every day. He said, I don't want to take a bucket of supplements. What supplements and vitamins should I take? He's 65, by the way, I didn't say that. What supplements and vitamins should I take at my age every day?
Look, I think, again, it depends on everyone's individual circumstance, but the basic bottom line here, I say, is that people should start supplementing, in my view, from about age 30. And the reason being is that 30 is the peak of our life, and sadly, it's all downhill from there. And when you hit 50 and the hormones go south, it gets even worse. So the studies have shown that taking a good quality multivitamin, and I've said, in my view, there's only one good quality multivitamin in Australia, every day over a long period of time has health benefits. So, for example, the Nurses' Health Study, the male physicians trial in Harvard, showing that up to 10 years taking multivitamin every day did nothing. But when you got to 10 years in the doctors, there was an 8% reduction in cancer and cataracts. When you got to 15 years in the females, the female nurses in the study, there was a 75% reduction in colon cancer, 25% reduction in breast cancer, 23% reduction in cardiovascular disease. When you got to 20 years in the doctors, so what anally retentive neurotic would take a multivitamin every day for 20 years? You're talking to one. There's a 44% reduction in cardiovascular disease. So there's pretty solid evidence that if you combine a good quality multivitamin, and I've already said before when I answered Maria's question, if you combine a good quality multivitamin with a healthy lifestyle, you do get an extra benefit. So that's from age 30. And with that, I think some form of omega-3 is a good thing to take. And again, the studies show that up to 5 years, they do nothing. But once you get beyond 5 years, there's around a 20% reduction in cardiovascular disease just by doing those simple things. When you hit 50, I think that's when people should start taking the bergamot products that I talk about that I have an association with. I can't name the product, but the ingredient is BJE100, one of those twice a day. And if you're otherwise healthy, that's all you probably need. There are other things that you may need. So, for example, if you have any muck in your arteries, vitamin K2 in a dose of 180 micrograms a day takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it in your bones. If you need some extra energy, ubiquinol is a good thing for energy, and magnesium orotate is a good thing for energy as well. So there's some basic things, but I take much more than that for a whole lot of other reasons, because I am an anally retentive neurotic.
Okay, there you go, Donald. Thank you for that, Dr. Ross. A new study that followed over 7,000 Canadians, middle-aged and older, for approximately 3 years, found that married men, or men who became married during the study period, were twice as likely to age in a positive way compared to their never married male peers. We've talked about this before, Ross. Marriage is good for your health.
Oh, no doubt whatsoever, especially if you're a male. And I say all the time, the commonest cause of divorce is marriage. And so when you look at this study, it shows clearly that married men really are much better off. And the worst health parameters were judged here in single men who had never married. And when you look at women, the figures weren't as strong for women, but again, women who were widowed or divorced during the study didn't do as well as women who had what they deemed were a happy marriage. So just looking at all of these parameters of optimum aging, things like being free from any serious physical, cognitive, mental, or emotional conditions that affect daily activities, as well as high levels of self-reported happiness, good physical health and mental health.
Why is it men are in a better position with this than women? Why is that?
I just think we're a bit more useless than women. I think that men are a bit more dependent in terms of their look. They don't look after themselves as well. I mean, I saw a guy today, first patient today. His wife's away, so he's just not cooking for himself. He's just not taking the same care. And I've got to say this in my own practice, and this might sound a bit sexist, but the women in my practice are just more diligent than many of the men. Some of the men are great, but some of them just don't put the effort in, and they expect their wife to mollycoddle them. And I know we're living in a society now where all of this stuff is more politically correct and frowned upon, but I'm just talking reality here.
According to new research, the drug, now let me get this right, is it elexanatant? Is that it, elexanatant?
That's it.
So this drug, elexanatant, significantly reduces the frequency and severity of hot flushes associated with menopause while improving women's quality of life.
And so, you see, a lot of women don't want to take hormone replacement therapies for, say, maybe they've got a strong family history of breast cancer, or they've had something like breast cancer themselves. And there has been this concern that hormone replacement therapy may increase your risk for cardiovascular disease and clotting. I think the research that suggests that's flawed, because there's a thing called the Women's Health Initiative. They took a bucket of women, and it didn't matter what age they were, they started them on hormone replacement therapy. So there are some women in this study over the age of 65 who'd never been anywhere near hormone replacement therapy. They gave them hormone replacement therapy, and they were the ones that got the stroke and the clotting and everything else, because their body wasn't used to it. But if you started hormone replacement therapy soon after the onset of menopause, the women didn't get those issues in almost all cases. But still, a lot of women say, no, I don't want hormone replacement therapy. So these drugs that are called neurokinin antagonists, there's one that's on the market in Australia now called Veozah, but the new one, the elinzanetant, that's a bit more of an improved version of this. 120 milligrams a day has been shown to markedly reduce the risk for hot flushing.
Can I ask you, for women that have had breast cancer and don't take hormone replacement therapy, how does it affect them, Ross, later in life?
Look, the problem with all of this, mate, is that I think with hormone replacement therapy, it's a third, a third, a third. So a third of women get a really enormous benefit from it. And I know women in their 60s, 70s and 80s, that if they stop their hormone replacement therapy, they get dreadful hot flushes and feel dreadful. But then a third of women, it doesn't hurt, doesn't really help that much. And a third will run into all the issues, especially the higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer that you get in those particular cases. So this is the point. Everybody is different and we all react to things differently.
A recent study has examined potential signals for suicidal and self-injurious adverse drug reactions. They call them ADRs. And this is associated with the weight loss drug Ozempic, Ross.
Yeah, look, it wasn't a huge increase, but when you looked at the odds ratio, there was 4.5 times more suicidal thoughts, self-injury in people who were using drugs like Ozempic compared with people who weren't. Now, 1.5 times sounds like a lot, but there weren't a huge amount of cases out of the amount of people who were using the Ozempic, but it still was statistically significant. So the takeaway point from this is, firstly, these drugs aren't harmless. Now, people think, oh, I'll just lose weight on this, I'll have no problems with it. 40% of people who use Ozempic get some degree of gastrointestinal upset, nausea, sometimes vomiting, certainly constipation or diarrhea, abdominal pain. But then there's a small but definite increased risk for things like pancreatitis, a very small but certainly definite increased risk for thyroid cancer, especially if you've got a strong family history of thyroid cancer. And if someone is using Ozempic and they start to have any mental health issues, it's important they get to their doctor immediately and discuss it with their doctor.
What are the downsides of something like an Ozempic? I saw articles only in the last 5 or 7 days, Ross, about the movie stars. And I think Nicole Kidman was one of the names that used in this article. You know, the Nicole Kidmans of the world and other movie stars, to keep their weight under control, are taking Ozempic. So therefore, people read this and think, God, if it's good enough for them, it's got to be good enough for me.
Look, I just don't get this nonsense. If a celebrity's doing something, it's got to be good for you. It's just complete rubbish. We're all human beings. We all are 99% identical with our DNA makeup. So why would a celebrity have any different DNA to the rest of us? But equally, a lot of people don't realise this, that Ozempic hasn't been studied for 10 or 15 years. It's only been studied for a few years. What we do see is, as soon as you stop, there's a huge rebound weight gain because your metabolism is being affected by this. You stop and your metabolism just changes dramatically. So you just put all the weight back on. So I say to anyone who's using Ozempic, this is the way I think it should be used. Use it to kickstart your weight loss program. So maybe you look to 12 months of Ozempic, you maybe lose on average about 15 kgs. When you've lost that, then you would cut your Ozempic back to once a fortnight, not once a week, for 3 months, then once a month for 3 months to just slowly wean it out of your system so you don't get that rebound weight gain. That's the way I think it should be used.
Let's finally talk about this review published in the journal Molecular Biomedicine. It provides a comprehensive overview of the METTL family. What's that, Ross?
We spoke about this recently. The METTL family is a family of methyltransferase genes that are directed by this MTHFR gene. And it was just something about the future of medicine. I think everyone should know what their MTHFR status is, because this METTL family, these methyltransferases, they're essential for cell differentiation, for what we call mitochondrial function, which are the energy packs in the cell. And also, if they go wrong, you can run into all sorts of diseases. So I think that we just need to get more and more of a focus on this very, very common genetic abnormality. The MTHFR gene mutation is as common, really, as insulin resistance. So two major gene abnormalities in the world, insulin resistance and MTHFR. So that was why I mentioned the METTL family.
All right, Ross, thank you so much for joining us each and every Saturday. We appreciate it. If you would like to send a question for Ross, you can send it to us 7 days a week. You know how to do that. Go to the website and look for the drop-down list of names and send your email to Brent Bultitude. And we will join Dr. Ross Walker next weekend and ask him more questions from our listeners. Thanks for your time, Ross, as always, mate.
My absolute pleasure.